Hi, food fans. Welcome to the Alton Brown Cast. I'm Alton Brown, your host. Today's going to be a pretty special show. We're going to be interviewing today a very, very good friend of mine and a guy in the food world that I really look up to, Simon Majumdar. If you have been a fan of the Next Iron Chef competition or Iron Chef America, you'll certainly be familiar with Simon Majumdar. This is a very, very cool guy, and I don't want to get too much into his backstory because I want him to be able to tell it, but a fascinating individual who I don't know if I've known anybody in my life more into food. I mean, seriously into food and understanding the connection between food and people and culture than this guy. Simon's kind of my Yoda when it comes to that. So he is going to be talking with us. We've got that to look forward to, and hopefully not too much of my droning voice in the next hour. So stand by. The show will be starting, and well, actually, it already did. Alton Brown, this is the Alton Brown Cast recording from my palatial dressing room on Iron Chef America, and I'm here with my mate for years past now, Simon Majumdar, who I've been looking forward to getting on the show.
Hello,
for a
Alton.
Long time.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So, being civilized gentlemen who are getting ready to do an Iron Chef battle, Simon and I are going to have some gin and tonics while we talk, and I'm going to be pouring Death's Door. Have you had Death's Door yet?
I have had Death's Door. I like it.
Okay.
It's a little light for me, if I'm honest.
I concur.
I like with my gin and tonics, I like a little oilier gin.
So I'm serving you the Jack Rudy Cocktail Company Small Batch Tonic, which they make in Charleston, which is going to be different from maybe some of the other tonics you've had. All they use in this stuff, I mean, it's quinine, water, citric acid, sugar, lemongrass, and orange peel. That's all it is. But I think it's pretty good in what it allows you to do. I like seltzer bottles, which is what I use at home, so that I don't have to have a bunch of tonic laying around. But we're going to have this with...
So this gives you the concentrate, so you can then just add
club soda
to it. Yeah.
Or seltzer.
Oh, that's rather good.
See, it's sweet.
Yeah.
It's a little sweet, but it's also got some quinine.
Ideally it needs some citrus with it. I think you need a... People here tend to do lime.
Whoa. I have lime. Will you accept lime?
I will accept lime. I have to say, normally I'm a lemon man, but lime will suffice.
Have you ever had it with key lime?
Oh, no.
Key lime's pretty great.
I've had it with calamansi lime. Now, that's something you should try. Given that I have a Filipino wife and lots of Filipino relatives, calamansi limes, those tiny little limes.
In a drink. They
are terrific. Very intense, very specific kind of lime flavor.
I have muddled kefir lime leaves into a glass and made gin and tonic.
You're not allowed to call it kefir lime leaves in the UK. You have to just call them lime leaves.
Are you serious?
Because the word kefir is a pejorative.
Now, I thought that's when you said kefir.
No. People have to be...
Here, I'm going to give you a real... Would you rather have a wedge or a...
No, that's perfect.
You want me to squeeze it?
Yes,
or,
please.
Okay, I'm going to give it a little bit of... There we go. I travel with a knife and limes. No, see if that helps at all.
I actually used to travel with a mixer and bottle and...
The whole thing?
Holy strainer and all of the whole works.
Not anymore?
Not so much. I just don't have room. I'm on the road I've been on the road for the last month and most of the last year.
That actually helps a lot. You have spent, though, a lot more time than that. Is that better?
Yeah, much better.
It's still a little sweet. But hey, we're roughing it here in the provinces. I want to talk to you somewhat about your... I don't think that the most Americans that know you from Next Iron Chef and Iron Chef America realize your backstory and how you got into this food thing, because you did not start in this food thing. You started in the publishing industry.
Well,
right?
I first started training to be an Episcopalian priest. Well, I studied theology.
But you found that your liver couldn't take that much liquor.
I found that my liver definitely couldn't take that. And the church, both I and the church, decided pretty quickly during my time as a theology student that the church wasn't for me. But I loved doing that as a subject at university, and I learned. You know, I found I was very good at redundant dead languages. So I was very good at New Testament Greek.
Because you were the first guy to tell me that every few years you reread the Odyssey in Greek.
Reread, and I read the New Testament in Greek every year. It's just more as an exercise in just kind of mental exercise than for anything religious. Although I'm a religious man at heart, but I read it just for interest. So, and it keeps my kind of New Testament Greek up to scratch, and I do some exegetical exercises from the old books that I have, and I have a great book on learning it. We're learning New Testament Greek called Wenham that I had 30 years ago when I was at university. I still have my same copy. And it's just, really, it's one of those things to stop your brain going to mashed potato. You know, when you're on the road and you want to do something intellectual. So I love doing that occasionally. So
I think that qualifies as intellectual. Because I have to admit, I've allowed my New Testament Greek to fall behind. I admit it. I have fallen behind on my New Testament Greek. So you were going to be... You studied to be a priest, and I assume, knowing you, that that was very much an intellectual thing for you, that you were as interested in that as you were in the spiritual aspects of that.
I am, and I think it was it turned out to be much more of an intellectual exercise than it did a spiritual exercise. And as soon as I realized that, I thought, well, it's definitely not something you can contribute your whole life to unless you become an academic. And quite frankly, I wasn't good enough to be an academic. You know, there was a big difference between me at my kind of lay level of intellect and study and what real, you know, professorial people do. So I ended up looking for a job and working in a bookshop, and then from there becoming a sales rep for Penguin. Some of the best days of my life, driving around in my free car and wandering into a few bookshops in London and having endless cups of tea with sort of older guys who love talking about books. Then I ended up in the publishing side, publishing books, and for years, the last 10 years before I started the second half of my life, I was publishing books, primarily a lot of cookbooks. And that's part of my kind of interest in food started.
Were you interested in it before that?
Food has been an obsession in our whole family life. I mean, our family, to the point where it's a sickness. I mean, it genuinely is. I had pictures today from my brother, my nephew and niece are visiting him, and all the pictures were of them eating. Every single one, 30 of them, just the different places taking them to eat. So the apples haven't fallen very far from the tree. We always say in our family that the Majumda way of saying, I love you, is, will you be eating that sausage? And it's true. Yeah. And the kind of critical aspect, my father reminded me about a week ago when I was chatting to him on Skype that when I was four, my mother made this doll, this life-saving doll that's one of our favorite
dishes. You've mentioned
dishes.
The life-saving doll before.
It's like our chicken soup. There's a recipe for it in my book, Eat My
right.
Globe.
There is.
And it is my favorite dish to cook, and it is our version of chicken soup. It's what you eat when you want to nourish both body and soul. You know, when you're feeling down or you have a cold or you eat this, and it's beautiful and warming, and it just makes you feel good. And my mother made this when I was about 4 years old, apparently, and I said, Mum, this is great, but was the shop that sold the good lentils closed today? So I think I've been doing this for...
So you've been criticizing people's food for quite a while.
I've been insulting chefs for over 30, nearly over 40 years now. And my father reminded me, he said, so it was pretty obvious you end up doing what you're doing for a living. How my mother didn't throttle me, I don't know. God bless her.
It's illegal.
Yes, I think in those days you probably would have got away. Would have been justifiable homicide.
Well,
they would have called
Canada,
it bratricide or whatever. Bratricide. I ended up doing this, and then I had a breakdown. I had a real full-on breakdown.
What brought this on?
My mother dying was one of the keys. Turning 40 was another. That was a real change. Really tough, actually. Very tough. I'm coming up to 50 soon, and I think 50 will be easier than 40. And then lots of other things. Stresses of work. The company I was working for that I was helping run was struggling a lot because of the economy and all sorts of things. And the changes in the publishing business and some mistakes that we and other people who ran the business made. And I had a full-on breakdown. I had one of those where I spent a night thinking I was going to jump off the balcony of my apartment in London. And I was saved by the fact that the Middle Eastern family in the apartment below started cooking. And I started smelling these amazing smells of roast meat and whatever else they were cooking. And I got more hungry than desperate. So I decided to live for a while and cook. And I cooked life-saving dal.
So this crisis happened all in a night.
It built up, but it reached this kind of what Douglas Adams, who wrote Hitchhiker's Guide, called the dark tea time of the soul.
Which I've unfortunately, I continue to have on a regular basis, but I understand what you mean.
I kind of reached that point, and I started cooking. I cooked life-saving dal, and I was doing, in fact, what my grandmother taught me to do, which was to stir the lentils, the dry lentils, in a pan with your fingers on a very, very low heat to toast them. And that when they become too hot to touch, then they're toasted enough. You take those out, and then you start preparing the dish with the onions, chilies, garlic, all the other things.
I've read the recipe.
Spices. But that toasting is very much part of it. Now, I have no idea. You'll be able to tell me more. This, if there's any scientific purpose. She always said that it kind of allowed the flavors to go into them more and added a nutty texture to the red lentils that we use. So,
I think toasting lentils makes complete sense.
So, I mean, and this was a family thing. And even now... all our family do it, and even friends I've taught, they tell me, they do this. And it's very therapeutic. So you're stirring away with your hands. But while I was looking around, I saw a notebook. It was up there on the shelf by my kitchen. And It was a notebook I'd bought when someone had given me one of those Anthony Robbins courses, you know, when I turned 40. And they're crazy. It was very American. Lots of Americans whooping and running over coals and stuff.
Yeah, whooping and hot coals. And
but I did. I got, and I couldn't listen to a lot of it. But I got one thing out of it, which was goal setting, which is still something I do every day. And is very much part of my kind of process. And I'd written down a series of things to do when I turned 40 or that I wanted to do, or at least soon after turning 14. It was like have a suit made on Savile Row, run a marathon, have my teeth straightened. And at the bottom, I'd just written four words. It was go everywhere, eat everything. And I suddenly went, okay. And that was it. The next day, I handed in my notice. And about a month after that, I was standing on Bondi Beach in Australia, wondering what I was going to do for the next year. And it kind of turned into the book. With a lot of help from some very well-known people like Anthony Bourdain, who didn't need to do it but gave me a great quote for the front of the book and also helped that which helped sell the book.
It's a great book. I think it's one of the true. I mean, a lot of people write travelogue food books. I mean, or attempt to, but I think because your mission was honest and heartfelt, you know, you were on more of a vision quest in a way, you know, because you'd had a crisis. And came to the point where you realized what it is you really wanted to do and set upon doing it. And I think that makes a difference.
Well, I hate to use the word authentic, but it was genuine authentic. And in fact, it still is. You know, those words go everywhere, eat everything have informed my entire life. And I'm now very lucky that, you know, my wife Sybil is someone who follows exactly the same mantra and comes along with me on the journeys. And in fact, was here yesterday while we were filming. And I think people tapped into that honesty about it. Even the journey I'm doing now for my new book wasn't about just going out there and having PR set it up and do it. This is now I'm becoming an American citizen, and that's something that I'm really excited about, and I want to do myself. So it's all paid for out of my own pocket. I organize it all myself, just as I did with Eat My Globe. You know, there was no assistance and PRs and all of this doing it for me. It's me. And I think that's something that people find a bit surprising. Now I have more of a profile certainly than I had then, but they also really react to it positively. I pick up the phone. I say, look, I'm really interested in what you're doing here, whether it's in Australia or, you know, South Africa or wherever I was in the world. And I went to 31 countries in a year for Eat My Globe. I've now
31 countries in a year.
Yeah, it was physically very demanding, but just astonishing in what I achieved. But I did everything from making whiskey in Scotland to being on the tea plantations in Darjeeling to fishing off the coast of Senegal to riding the Trans-Siberian Express to go to the Sherry Fair in Jerez in Spain. I mean, I really crammed it in, and it was almost a bit like that film, you know, if it's Tuesday, it must be Belgium.
Right.
And it wore me out in many ways. I think physically I've never, you know, quite recovered from the rigors of it, because I was like the oldest backpacker in town with my big red rucksack.
Your big red.
Who's in retirement now.
But you still have Big Red, right?
I would never get rid of Big Red. Red's too much part of my life.
Okay, good. Because actually a picture, for those of you that haven't seen the book, there's actually a picture on the cover, of at least the paperback edition, which is trying to get Big Red clothes, this gigantic red suitcase that you lugged around.
Took around the world. And you know, it gave me amazing opportunity. But at the heart of it, food was kind of the prism that I use, because that's my life. And it still is my life. You know, we've spent hours just talking about food. Yeah, we do it every time there's a cut in Next Iron Chef or Iron Chef. We swap emails about, have you seen this about gin, or have you seen this about this? And I think it's one of those things that people really tap into, the fact that food is universal. So I use that as my way of getting to know people. And it actually gave me incredible opportunities to connect with strangers, because, you know, I was on trains going from Marrakesh to Fez. I was flying through Brazil or wherever I was, and I told people what I was doing, and immediately it was, well, you should share my food now, or you should come here, or let me take you to dinner while you're in.
It's like a switchboard. It plugs everybody and everybody else.
It absolutely does, and it is doing now with this journey. So,
I've been following, because you do a lot of this on Twitter, and you talk about this a lot on Twitter, and those of you that don't follow Simon, you should, @SimonMajumdar on Twitter. And I get a real kick out of kind of watching you plot and plan and move around the country.
Well, I've used social media in a way that I wasn't able to with the first book. Twitter really wasn't around.
No, it wasn't around.
Facebook was just getting going.
But even then, Facebook wouldn't have been it's not the right tool for that kind of
thing. It's not as instant. I mean, this new book, which is... So, I mean, to talk about that, it's for me very important when I live in a country that I do anything, in fact, that I really participate. I really become part of this experience. So I'm lucky enough now. I'm a resident alien. I've just got my full time green card. And
you did.
Congratulations!
I had a green card, but it was the different version. Right?
Well, they would only give you one for 2 years, because I hadn't been married for 2 years.
Oh, okay.
So now I have my kind of permanent green card, so you kind of, it's very difficult to get rid of me.
Next step. Next step, American.
Next step, an American citizen. And I, because I want to. I want to, I don't want to be, as you know from me, I don't do anything in a partial way. I want to be wholly part of what I'm doing. Yeah. And I, and that kind of participatory element is something I picked up from reading George Plimpton, who's my hero, my literary
George
hero.
Plimpton. Great who, sports writing.
Well, the sports books are, to me, the best books on sport ever written. And he wrote particularly the one where he did Shadowbox, where he trained to do an exhibition with Archie Moore, which is just wonderful. But also the one he wrote about the Detroit Lions.
That's the one that most Americans
would
know.
And Out of Their League with the Brooklyn Dodgers. And they're great books. And he was this very unusual character because he was a very lanky academic guy. But he threw himself into being with these people. And he wrote about them in a really affectionate, really heartwarming way. Mm-hmm. And that's what I try and do when I write about the people who I meet on this journey. And so I've used Twitter and various other ways. And I said to people, you know, I'd love to find out what 4th of July means.
Mm-hmm.
So I got people going, oh, you should go to Philly, you should go to Boston, all of which makes sense. They're great cities and obviously very much part of that early American story. But I got someone going, why don't you come to Brainerd, Minnesota and start our pig race? Well, I'd never heard of Brainerd, Minnesota.
Well, not many have.
And so I said, well, yes. And I'm a great believer in saying yes when people say, would you like to come and do this? Because you put yourself in just amazing opportunities, amazing experiences.
So what was it like?
So I went up there. I didn't start the pig race, because but I did take part in the 15-year-old girls' bed push race. I was the honorary captain. They lost to a team run by the mothers. I went up there, and it was everything you'd imagine. It was very Norman Rockwell. There was all kind of minnow races going on, And then I went to have someone teach me how to make the perfect apple pie. Then I met, this is the one that I think would make you laugh, I met a guy called Rick who's runs a donut stall, but he's also a cop. And on his, he has a motto that says, after years of taking, I decided it was time to give back to the donut community.
Nice. How are the donuts?
They were actually really, really good. He's got this fantastic little machine that's like a mini version of something you see in Krispy Kreme. And right. It just churns them out at all different sizes. And they're really fun. And he sells them in little cones.
But the fact that he was cop. The I fact mean, that's that he's a cop. Cop, is donut, just, donut, cop.
I mean, it was,
makes sense.
You know, it was fantastic. Then I ended up going around the lakes on the 4th of July itself, and some mm-hmm. people invited me to share their meal overlooking the lake and the fireworks going off, and they put out this huge spread of food. And they, actually, they grilled ribs. I'd never seen this before. They grilled ribs on an army cot. So they had an old army cot that the guy had had when he was in the army.
Okay.
It's this guy in his 80s from South Dakota. Plonked it down. They had fire, charcoal underneath it. They got it burning all day. Then they put sheet metal around it.
And so then, what kind of grate was across?
It was the springs of the...
Just the springs?
It was the springs of this army cot, like the wire springs that you get in one of those old rickety cots.
Right.
And then they laid the ribs on top of them.
And just turned it into a grill?
Just turned it into a grill. Army cot ribs. It was...
That's very American, though, to make do and to jerry-rig something, you know, out of something else, to hack it. That's an American
well,
thing.
It's an American thing, and actually that's what I'm trying to do. What I'm trying to do with this book, new book, Fed, White, and Blue.
Fed, White, and Blue. I'm glad you finally said it. I was waiting for you to say the title.
Is to become an American. I have to find out what that means, because the beauty of becoming an American is it really can mean anything you want. I mean, I'm very proud to be British. I will never give up on my British passport, and please God, I never lose my British accent. Yeah, I'd never get any more work, I don't think, because I have nothing else going for me. But... But I really want to try and understand what it means. And the only way I thought I could understand is by, A, through food,
right,
and B, by using food to meet people and have them explain what they do and see some great American experiences. So I really asked America to invite me to come and find out what it means. So the book's called Fed, White, and Blue, Breaking Bread with America.
And how do you think you're doing as far as figuring out America via food?
I think... Yeah, so far, I have to say, A, I'm having a great time. So at the bottom line, that's fine. You know, because I've done everything so far from making beer in Seattle to working in a food bank in Texarkana to spending a week in Nebraska following calves from falling out of the back of their mother to cooking steaks at the Nebraska Club. A kosher barbecue festival.
Which one?
It's in Kansas City. It's called...
I've heard of this.
I'm going to Madison, Wisconsin for the Cheese Festival. Then I'm in Denver for the Great American Beer Show. A couple of weeks ago, I was killing frogs with a Native American guy called Johnny Tigertail down in the Everglades.
Well, we were talking about that. That's what you did after we worked together on Cutthroat Kitchen.
Absolutely.
And how did it go? Tell me about the frogging. I've been frogging, but it's been a really long time.
It was really interesting because this is the Mississauga tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a relatively newly recognized tribe. And it took DNA testing to prove that they were a separate part of the Seminole. Because obviously most of the community down there are Seminole. So they're now a separate community. I think I say recent, but we're only talking the last 40, 50 years, so not hundreds
That's
of years.
Recent for them. That, definitely. For all of us, yeah.
They have, on the basis of that, their own land in the Everglades, acres of it, and they all have their own family, what they call tree islands. So and the majority of them raise money by airboat tours and all of that
sure.
kind of thing.
Tourist stuff.
So I was invited down there by Johnny Tigertail. I mean it's a great name. And he was this lovely chap. And he took me out in his airboat. And he took me around. Spent a couple of days showing me the land and showing me the water and just how connected they were to the water. Then we went out, I think it was garfish we were fishing for with bow and arrow. I've got some great pictures.
Did you get one?
I didn't. He did.
He did.
He yeah. did. My arrows were like, I was like, well, I'm trying to think who it was now. Robin Hood who fired it into the air and they had to go and look for it.
Yeah.
he did, but this guy was just,
poof. Yeah.
It was second nature to him. You see sometimes, it reminded me a bit of when I was in Mongolia and I woke up one morning and walked out. It was about 4 o'clock in the morning and the sun was coming up and I heard this noise that sounded like thunder, but the sky was blue. And I suddenly just saw these two Mongolian guys on horseback, standing in the saddle, almost like Yul Brynner in a film you could imagine, chest naked from the sort of waist up, and they're just riding along. And they were in their on the horses, but standing up in the syrup at full gallop. And it just looked like they were at one with the horse. And as Mongolians are, they're born and bred.
On horses.
On horses. And eat horses and drink horses' milk. In the same way with Johnny, the way he just had that bow and arrow, It was an extension of his arm. And then when we began to gig for the frogs, it was the same.
All right, so now the size of the frogs you were gigging for was, you were gigging for bullfrogs,
yes.
right?
Okay. And then we caught a few of them, and then we made our way to the tree island, and his wife and his sister then prepared the frogs for us, and we turned them into frog's legs.
Can you talk a little bit about what the preparation was?
It's really just they skin them, they gut them, they and then they cut. Almost
how big
like,
were they? How big were the bullfrogs then? Because the gigging that I've done has been mostly in little marshes and swamps in northern Georgia, not down in the Everglades.
These,
these were pretty sizable. Frogs.
They're almost. Some of them were pretty much like the size of your microphone, which is what, about 8 inches, 9 inches tall.
We're talking about probably frogs in the 1 pound range,
yeah,
one
probably
and
a little
pound
bit
range,
more, one to one. I mean, some of them
half
big,
kilo, kind
yeah,
of thing.
big frogs. And we deep fried. We just floured and deep fried the legs, and we sat there on their tree island, eating these frogs legs. They were gorgeous. I mean, just
can you describe the tree island? Because I mean, I've seen one, but it's tough to explain. To
well,
folks,
really, isn't. Everyone. There are certain clumps of land where the water recedes a little bit. And the ground is firm enough in the Everglades that you can build on it.
Right.
And each person in the tribe or each family or clan in the tribe has their own blocks of tree islands. And they have ownership on them and they pass down. It's their land. And they use them really as kind of almost like holiday spots. And they build houses there. They build shelters. They go hunting there when they've gone fishing out.
I mean, there's like little cabins, or how would you describe it?
They have cabins. They have sometimes they don't use cabins at all. They just have shelters and underneath hammocks. They always have a fire pit centrally because the fire is so essential, A, for cooking and warmth, but also it's very much part of the Mississauga cultural thing. And they go there, and sometimes when they need to disappear, and for them, disappearing, as it were, and connecting with their land is incredibly important, as Johnny was explaining to me. And so sometimes he said, you know, he'll just go off there for 2 or 3 days. And his wife knows that if he doesn't come back one night, there's nothing to worry about. He's just needed to go and reconnect. But also, Johnny Tigertail, is very connected to wildlife preservation there. That's something he feels very strongly about. And it was something that was quite scary. He has these huge alligators just wandering around in the on the tree island. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're cut, so they can't kind of jump out at people when you go there.
But they're still big, and it's very impressive.
He jumps in and feeds them. They're his pets. He's had them since he was kids. And there's one there who was born before he was, called Mama Gator. And someone had killed a deer and given him some meat, so he jumped in and started feeding it as if you were feeding a cat out of your hand.
Wow.
And then he asked me if I wanted to have a go, and I suggested it might not be a good idea.
Yeah, you might be right, not recognized as a friend.
That was one of the really fascinating experiences. I caught lobsters up in Maine. I was just with a great community in New Jersey who are called the Bay Rats in southern Jersey. And I've got, not knowing so much about that part of the world, I didn't realize how southern South Jersey is. I mean, it's only a mile from the Mason-Dixon line.
That's right.
And it's
right on it.
Group of fishermen and hunters who really have suffered because of Sandy and because of the economy. But this community that really looks after each other. They make their money from clamming. So I went out clamming with them. They go out on the boats every day. They drink a lot while they're out on the boats. Credence playing on the thing, or Iron Butterfly, whatever.
Butterfly.
Zooming across the... and it's very near Atlantic City, is in the background, mm-hmm. but it's beautiful, sure. Beautiful land. Water, and we were fishing for perch and just cooking them up on the beach and living this life that's very protective of this community, just looking after each other. And I really enjoyed that because I think that's a very American experience as well, about this neighborliness in times of hardship. And I think it's something that might be disappearing but shouldn't, because to me that's a real American story. And lots of other stories so far. I've cooked in a Filipino kitchen. I'm going to be cooking in Jeffrey Zakaria's kitchen. And he said, you should come back.
His home kitchen or his restaurant kitchen?
No, his restaurant kitchen. Okay. He said, you need to come and find out what it's like to be in a hardcore restaurant kitchen. So he's going to put me through my paces. I've got lots of other great experiences. I'm going off to Alaska to fish for salmon.
Have you spent time in Alaska before?
It's the only state I've never visited. I've visited every other state.
It will mess with your mind. It's that whole, midnight sun business. It just gets kind of dark about 1 a.m. and then it's light again by 4. And when you first hook into a salmon, a good sized salmon, it really puts a spin on your head. It's a very different world up there, man.
I mean, I've experienced midnight sun in,
you're in Scandinavia places, sure.
And midsummer, which is a big part of their experience. But I've never been to Alaska before. And that will actually mean that I'll have visited 70 countries in the world and every state of the United States. And I don't think many people can say that. It's one of the things.
70 countries.
Yeah. And there's a lot more to go. A lot more to go.
One of my great fantasies is for you and I to go to India.
I think India messes with people. I love it. I mean, I always describe India as being like a girlfriend that is really bad for you, and then just as you're about to go, I've had enough. That's it. I'm never. We're done. It does something so magical and alluring and beautiful that you suddenly go, now I'm trapped again.
I'll stay.
And I took Sybil there for the first time last year, and the pollution was like you've never seen in your life in Delhi. We all got very ill because they'd been burning the crops in Uttar Pradesh.
Well, then why'd you even go to Delhi?
Well, because we wanted to do the part of the Golden Triangle. We did a very touristy kind of trip there because she'd never seen Jaipur, and she wanted to go, of course, to the Taj Mahal. And everybody should go to the
Taj
Mahal.
Who doesn't want to see the Taj Mahal? I want to see the Taj Mahal.
It is as beautiful. I've been there now six or seven times. And every time you go, you think, it can't possibly be. And then you see it, particularly when you go in the morning. You get there.
You get that morning
light. You stand
in
line at about 5 o'clock. It's very organized now. You go and get your tickets. You have to really go with a guide now because of the way they've organized it. They've actually stopped any big industry in Agra, where it's based, to try and protect it from pollution. They're very protective of it now because obviously it is a symbol of India more than any other.
It's the symbol of India.
I mean, you would see Big Ben or the Eiffel Tower. They would show the Taj Mahal, and you immediately know where
you're
done. But you go in a little before 6, just as the sun is rising behind it, and it is every bit as magical every time you go there. And Sybil and myself have a rather cheesy picture of the two of us sitting looking at the sun rising over the Taj. And even then, Sybil said to me, I get it. After all the pollution, all the poverty, all the noise, all the dirt, all the power cuts, all the craziness that is India, she said, you see this, and I get why you keep on wanting to come back. And then we went to Kerala and to Goa, where I think some of the best food in India comes from, particularly seafood. And Goa, of course, is very different because it was a Portuguese colony, not a British colony, until the 60s. So they're, a lot of them are Christian. Their names are all very kind of, all Portuguese. They're also called Santa Cruz or whatever. And they cook pork, which is very unusual in terms, from a food point of view in India. But beautiful food. In fact, some of my favorite in the whole country.
Now that you're becoming an American, and you've been to every state, and you've eaten in every state, but you're also a citizen of the world. What are three spots on planet Earth that you think every American should go to?
Well, we've just talked about one.
India would be one. Okay, so give me one spot in India that I need to go to.
One spot.
And you know me well enough. Where, if you would say, Alton, you need to go to, what is it in India? Where? I mean, is it Delhi?
I think you would be very moved by just going to the tea plantations of Darjeeling.
Very much so, I would.
That, to me, is a very special place. You know, obviously, your love of tea. The history of tea, because obviously a lot of it was, tea was never found in India, and the British brought it in, and they actually had this gentleman who kind of disguised himself as a Chinese guy, went in and stole plants and brought them out. Right. It's a great story
of an industrial espionage story.
Make a great film. But he came back and they planted them in Assam, and then they just realized they could make better tea up in Darjeeling, up in the hills. And all the people who pick them are, I think they're Nepalese or Tibetan, but they have tiny little fingers.
So they can get that first
four buds
when you're doing the first flush.
And to be able, I think one of the things that would change your life, and it certainly did mine, I was at a plantation called Gumti, and it's a very famous plantation for first flush and second flush Darjeelings. And they were picking the first flush, and we were out in the fields with them. And then the next morning for breakfast, we drank that tea that had been picked the day before. It had been withered and dried.
They had just enough time to
do it. Because they go out very, very early in the morning. It's like 4 or 5 o'clock. You go out with them. And then you go and they'll make the tea for you for breakfast the next day in their guest house. And there's something very special about that.
All right, what's number two?
Number two to me would be to go to Scotland and visit a great Scotch distillery. And
I'm liking this tour so far, by the way. It's a beverage tour
I think because of the context. I know you're a bourbon man, and I adore bourbon. But
bourbon is just the Scotch of America. And then actually, in a way, rye is even more the Scotch of America. But Scotch, and I like Islay Scotches.
And that's where I would go. And I was very lucky to go there to make whiskey. And much as I adore bourbon, I don't think there's any comparison if I was offered one. I got into trouble a few years ago because I said that bourbon was the frat boy drink and Scotch was the grown-up drink. And I don't think it's true.
I'm not insulted by that. And I understand what you mean by that.
It's elegance and complexity of a Scotch compared to even the best bourbon. There's no comparison as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. And I adore bourbon. I just don't think you could put them in the same breath.
It's a gateway drug. I mean, when you get serious, you know, it's like some of the Compass Box whiskeys that I started buying after you told me about them. And I've got an almost done bottle of Peat Monster at home now.
Well, Peat Monster is my favorite whiskey.
Peat Monster is, and I bought my first bottle of Peat Monster. I couldn't find it. It was hard to find for a while.
Oh, really?
And then I found it at this little rundown liquor store down in like Florida someplace. I'm like, oh my God, they got 5 bottles of Peat Monster. They must have had an allotment and nobody bought it. And that's when I really started trying to become serious about my Scotch drinking after conversations with you. And the complexities that are there both in the the aroma and in the flavor, I have to say, are well beyond what American bourbon typically delivers. It's true.
And I think it doesn't have to do with terroir. I absolutely don't believe in terroir. People talk about that with spirits, and it's nonsense because, of course, they're all distilled.
It makes sense because it's all cooked out of it.
Yeah. So, but there is a context. So when I drink anyway, because of my travels of Scotch, particularly an Islay Scotch, I can't help but think of those that I tasted in the still rooms of Laphroaig or Lagavulin or Beaumont.
Do you prefer Laphroaig to Lagavulin or Lagavulin to Laphroaig?
There's a 21-year-old Lagavulin sherry cask.
Oh, I haven't had that one.
That I think is the single greatest whiskey, sort of readily available whiskey outside of those you spend thousands of dollars on the planet. And you drink that, and you sip it, and you get that sweetness that from the Lagavulin. Oloroso that they use. And it's an interesting story now because Spain doesn't produce enough sherry to deal with the casks. That's one of the reasons why they had to go to bourbon to start getting the barrels.
Because they just didn't have the barrels.
They just didn't have them. And, of course, with bourbon, you can only use the barrel once. So they've created this very...
Legally.
So they've created this symbiotic relationship between bourbon and scotch, which I think is rather great. Jim Beam is very strong as a supplier.
We should make a show where we jump back and forth between bourbon country and... Because here's the thing, my plane can make it to Scotland, by the way. I just want to mention that. Yeah, we could fly.
Wow.
We could fly from Kentucky to Scotland.
That would be incredible. Oh, well, I mean, but you drink this Lagavulin then, and you'll understand, because they're actually, what I was saying is, sorry, with the barrels, they're actually making sherry.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me, having it shipped to Scotland.
Right.
They sit it in the barrels just to infuse them for 2 or 3 years. And this is the other thing. They're making whiskies. They really think ahead. That's one of the things about Scotch that I think differentiates it from so many other things. They're making things that will be ready in 12, 10 years. They're not thinking of things that you need to make cash on. You know, these are cash-rich companies, these big distillers, so they can think ahead. So they will have sherry sitting in these barrels for 2 or 3 years to get the flavor in. They then send
just to get the flavor in the barrel.
Just get the flavor in the barrel.
What do they do with the sherry? They send
it
sherry
back to Spain to make vinegar, sherry vinegar. And then they now have a sherry barrel. Glenlivet do that, Glenfiddich do it. A lot of the big ones do that with their sherry barrels because they want those sherry barrels for the special editions. So they have, again, a great relationship.
So it's not about the standard issues, it's about the special editions.
These special editions that they need to have. Because sherry barrels have become a kind of a limited edition thing. Then they will toast those barrels and then they will use those barrels as if they were old sherry barrels. So Lagavulin do this. So you get this Oloroso, which is obviously a little bit more sweet.
There's some nuttiness in there that you probably wouldn't get out of the scotch.
Exactly. And then you obviously have the whiskey, and it's in there for 21 years. Now, you'll know the science better than I will, but there's a point at when what the sherry takes from the wood and what the wood takes from the whiskey and the wood takes from the whiskey stops. And about 21 years is about that, I would have thought, is what they tend to put on the lid, although you can find 50-year-old or whatever whiskies.
Yeah, but it's kind of like stereos. It's like, you know, there are a lot of us that can hear the difference between a $1,000 stereo and a $15,000 stereo, but there aren't too many of us that can hear the difference between a $15,000 stereo and a $100,000 stereo.
I know, I can't.
It's the same with
whiskeys.
Yeah.
I can definitely tell the difference between a kind of, you know, a $25 bottle and a $200 bottle. Of course, I can absolutely tell it. Going much above that, that's where I start to go, well, you know, you need to be one of the master tasters.
Well, that's that 21-year level, though, that you're talking about.
When
you're starting to get into age, you're really talking about losing moisture, and you're talking about, you're not getting anything more out of the wood.
Nothing more out of the wood, and the wood isn't wood isn't taking anything from the whiskey.
It's a static equation at that point.
Yeah,
everything's at equilibrium.
So that's when you tend to open them. And when we were in Lagavulin, they opened one of these barrels, and it's still one of the great tastes, probably in the top five tastes of my entire life.
What are the others?
That's a very interesting question. I'm going to have to think about it. Well, so
because you threw that out there very quickly.
I did throw it out. They are probably, a lot of them will be booze related. Actually, no. Eating ham on Ibérico in Extremadura in Spain. Ham on Ibérico is, in my mind, the greatest food product ever.
Well, you've told me so many times about the place where they hung them from the ceiling with the paper kind of cone things under them that caught the fat when it dripped out. I haven't been to Spain. So
if you go to anywhere in Spain, but particularly in western Spain, so where they have Extremadura, where the ham on Ibérico comes from, and ham on Ibérico is the breed, obviously Ibérico pig, and then ham on Ibérico de Bellota is this really high end where it's all just fed on acorns. It's the most rigorously tested food product in the world. They come along every day, measure its feces, make sure it's eating 7 kilograms of acorns a day. Then the butchering is watched by the DO people. Then the curing is watched by them. And then after 4 or 5 years with the grand reservers. It's still tested with a horse bone, and they sniff it, and if the curing isn't exactly to perfection, it could be sold, but not as ham on Ibérico de Bellota. So
they're holding out.
A whole ham, probably $2,500. I mean, so you're talking about a lot of money, and it goes into them.
$2,500 or euros?
Dollars.
Dollars for ham.
Yeah, for a ham. I mean, I think it's the most expensive, or one of per ounce, the most expensive food products, you know, in the world. And certainly one of the hardest to create. I mean, it puts any other ham. People talk about San Daniele and you know, a lot of other hams. It puts them in. I mean, there's nothing comes close.
They're just not in the same class.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful ham. But if you go into bars in Spain, even bars, but great restaurants as well, the whole ceiling will be covered with hams just hanging there. And because the fat in the ham, it's so full of oleic acid because they're eating acorns. In fact, an oleic acid, obviously, from olives, same acid. They actually call the pigs olives with legs in Spain, which is I love. And it's the fat is actually very good for you. In fact, they will in Japan they ask people to eat it to reduce their cholesterol, the pig fat, which I think is
love that.
I know, it's a very Japanese
more pig
take.
Fat. Yeah, that is very Japanese.
But because the fat has such a high oleic acid content, it will actually at room temperature it'll begin to melt.
Sure, because it's liquid at room temperature.
Yeah, so they actually put these little look like little umbrellas. Plastic umbrellas, they shove them in the bottom of each ham. So as the fat begins to kind of melt slowly, and it takes days to, I mean, it just drips into this little umbrella and collects there. So it doesn't go on the floor or drip on the customer.
Sure.
So what they will do sometimes in really great bars is they will carve this ham, very thin slices. You have to be able to read the name of the maker of the knife through the ham as they're carving these beautiful slices. No one in America really gets it right when they carve it. They always kind of hack away at it like medieval surgeons. It's a real skill. And it's a trained skill, just like sushi cutting is in Japan. And they will cut it, and they lay it out like little petals on a flower. And then what they'll do is they'll often have bowls of roasted almonds just sitting warming in the sun in the window. They'll come and pour those in the middle of the bowl. And then they'll reach up and grab one of these umbrellas with the oil. And they'll just dribble that ham oil over the warm roasted almonds.
Oh, man.
And then sprinkle a little bit of salt on top. And it's so sexy.
You have that with a little sherry?
You have it with a glass of Fino sherry.
That's it.
And it, to me, probably the great food experience on earth. And it's worth flying to Spain. I haven't been back to Spain now in 2 years, and we have a family home down in the south.
Well, I got a lot of miles piled up in my account, so I'm more than happy to go to Spain with you if you want to go have some ham. But right now, I got to send you off to make an Iron Chef America episode. I've kept you past your call time. But that's been Simon Majumdar. We'll do part two because we got a lot more stuff to talk about.
Yeah, no, we only got two food experiences.
I know, and I'm buying you some time to figure out some three others. We got the Scotch, we got the Iberico.
Fish and chips would be in there somewhere.
Fish and chips, and I know you've got a favorite fish for that.
Oh, absolutely, haddock.
Haddock,
baby.
Haddock. Next time when Sam and Jim Dar is on the Alton Browncast. Thanks, Simon.
A pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right, food fans, that's about all we have for today's show. I want to thank all of you for listening. I want to thank Simon Majumdar for giving us some of his precious time and sharing some of his thoughts and experiences. Great guy, always interested in what he is doing. If you would like to read more of his work or read his work if you haven't, check out Eat My Globe or Eating for Britain, two of his books that are personal favorites of mine. So that's it. Thanks a lot for listening. And until next week, America. Cook smart.